Hello, I'm Richard Ady. This is Best Practice. And how we do is important. It's culture. Culture's fundamental to every organisation, drives performance, and when trouble strikes, it's the thing that might save your firm from ruin. Today on the programme, we'll take a closer look at culture with the help of some experts. Sean McCarthy is the chair and CEO of consulting firm Human Synergistics. Peter Hartnett's head of people and culture at Sanitarium. And Mary Lemonis is vice president of human resources for Campbell's Asia Pacific. And let's start with you, Mary. We hear about the importance of culture a lot, but what is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think definitionally you'll hear people say things. It's the way we do things around here. It's the unseen. It's the intangible. It's the system in some respects. From my perspective, and as I'm talking about at the Human Synergistics Conference, I think it's more personal than we realise. So yes, it's the system, but it's also about the individuals that make up the system. It's the way we are. It's the way we operate.
Peter, it's often not written down at all.
No, it's not. And I had a conversation with Matthew Croxford from Human Synergistics a few years ago, and he said, you know, it's really like if you're the fly on the wall, what do you see? And, you know, what do you see in terms of people's behaviours? What do you see in terms of their interactions? And as Mary said, you know, that's a very personal thing.
Sean, what are the things that contribute to it, that kind of make it up?
Okay, so culture itself is basically behavioural norms. So how are people expected to behave? So we have social norms. So there are certain social norms about what you do and don't say on the radio, for instance. So they're acceptable or they're unacceptable because they get rewarded or punished. So therefore, it's how the organisation system rewards and punishes behaviour through things like incentives, remuneration systems, the structure. So the structure, for instance, whether or not people are actually involved in decision-making or it's a very hierarchical, centralised structure. The HR systems around how do you get a job, how do you get promoted, the communication systems, and last and not least, the job design in terms of the levels of autonomy and that kind of thing that's built into jobs.
I have to say, from my own observations and just, you know, working for a long time now, culture always wins. If a new manager comes in who's not familiar with the culture or chooses to ignore the culture will win and the manager will lose. Yeah,
absolutely. It's like a shadow over everything. That people, new CEOs come in and their stated intention is to change the culture. Unless they actually change some of the things that happen in the organisation at the fundamental level, the culture will actually overwhelm that. And I've seen that. That's why often you see with new change in large corporations, the first CEO won't last, the second one will actually make the change happen, because to some extent the first one becomes the sacrificial lamb to the change.
Yeah. Mary, coming back to you, what are the consequences when the culture's not working or not constructive?
Look, I think they vary. It's a continuum. It's things that you can see, you can actually see performance, you know, and I think we wouldn't be sitting here talking to you if we didn't believe that it mattered for performance, that constructive cultures really do drive performance. I think what's really interesting is what happens when the proverbial really does hit the fan. I think, you know, the true test of culture is not actually the good times but the bad times. And so, you know, the consequences of having a robust culture means that you weather the storm a hell of a lot better. I've seen some, you know, supposedly good cultures unravel under the stormy weather, and I think that's when you know that the underlying culture isn't as sound as what it was perceived to be.
Yeah, and certainly you can have dysfunctional cultures that are high performance.
Absolutely.
So there's lots of goals being kicked or sales being made, you know, it's all good. And then it's not good.
The question is sustainability. I think it comes down to short-term versus long-term.
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
Cultures, you know, you can operate well in a vacuum with a poor culture for a short period of time, but I think sustainability is the real test for a great culture. You know, we talk in our business about the virtuous circle, but it goes two ways. You know, culture drives, you know, how people behave, it's how they feel, and it drives performance, but the cycle goes both ways.
Yeah.
So if the business is performing badly, to me, that's the true test of culture.
Peter, I want to ask you about something that we also talk about a lot on this show, and it's been very much a kind of word that HR has focused on for the last 5 years, and that's engagement. Australia has some of the lowest levels of engagement in the world. I don't have to tell you that. How does that connect with culture?
The way that we look at engagement, engagement is much more of a temperature check and something that can actually be manipulated quite easily, whether it's rewards or the way in which a system or a process works, whereas culture, it's much deeper than that. I think as Mary said, it's much more personal and you can change behaviour quite fleetingly. So and that's what engagement tends to can tend to measure. But it does give you a sense check about, you know, perhaps how things are travelling, but culture goes, it just peels back the layers a lot more.
Engagement is more or less, this is simplifying it, how much people care about their work and how they feel about it and how invested they are.
What they say with engagement is, you know, say, stay, strive. You know, what do people say about the organisation? Am I going to stay in the business? And how hard will I actually work for the business? And those measures, you know, it's a very, for me, it can be, it's something that we do measure, but it's not, we don't hang our hat on it. We prefer to go deeper into the culture to really understand what the key drivers are, what the levers are that we're pulling. And that drives certain outcomes for us as a business, whereas the engagement doesn't necessarily give you what those key drivers are and what you need, what the levers are that you really need to change.
I'll come back to what you've been doing at Sanitarium in a moment, but Sean, we've already touched on this idea that if there's, you get a new chief executive and it's sort of chief executive versus culture, it'll be culture one, chief executive nil. But if you want to build culture or change culture, can you do it from the top?
Short answer to that is yes. In fact, it has to involve the top. The CEO needs to be part of that, let's call it change. And it can be bottom up or top down, but whichever way you go, the CEO needs to be part of that deal. So in terms of the sort of culture one, CEO zero, it's really where the CEO fails to get support of the senior executives around her or him. And that's the key. You can't do it on your own. So when CEOs go in saying, I'm a change agent, I'm going to do everything differently, that's when people basically look at them and say, yeah, right. And so it's about creating a coalition of the willing, if you like, around yourself in order to create a groundswell of momentum around the need to do things differently.
Yeah, and when you're recruiting into that, you've got to get the people who don't necessarily appear on the organisational chart as having the, I suppose, institutional power and influence, because there's always that kind of shadow culture where it's people whose job description say something quite else but have enormous sway.
Yeah. This is one of the great fallacies people talk about recruiting to cultural fit. Whilst that seems very comforting and comfortable, in fact, it might be an aggressive person being recruited into an aggressive culture, so it's a culture fit. But in fact, the culture itself needs to change.
How do you engender a common understanding of what practices are desirable and what will be discouraged?
Well, the key is to have good research behind that. I mean, since the 1940s, there's been substantial research on what works and what doesn't work. This is one of, again, I've been in consulting for 43 years, and I'm still telling the same stories about what needs to be done today as I was back in the 1970s. It's really no different. It's really quite fundamental. It's involve people. It's communicate with people. It's allow people to be part of the process. It's about reinforcing and rewarding constructive behaviours. It's about working hard to make sure that your managers and leaders are the very best that they can be and that they in turn understand the impact that they have. So basically culture is the collective impact of everything that we do inside the organisation. So you said earlier, for instance, that Australia has relatively low engagement rates. One way to think about culture and engagement is think of an iceberg. So engagement is what you can see above the surface. Culture is what's underneath the surface, and you really don't quite know what's there until you look at it very carefully. And so it is about creating a sense of fundamental respect. I mean, that's a very broad phrase, respect for people. If you do that, then you get them on board and change happens.
I want to come back to you, Mary, because HR and your head of HR, is that? I'm sure you have a different official title.
That will do fine.
Because you're in the middle of this. So it's not just your culture is not just your job, it's everybody's job. But you kind of have to manage the tensions and the paradoxes.
Yep.
And often things can be quite literally conflicting. How do you deal with that?
One of the thought leaders in HR, David Ulrich, has you know, just refreshed their new model through the RBL group, and they've added in a competency called Paradox Navigator for HR professionals. So I don't know if you knew that.
I didn't know that.
But now you do.
To me, the subscript is, here is another reason why your job is impossible.
Yeah. but I think we all face tensions, right? You know, whether it's CEOs, HRDs, whatever, you know, there's short versus long term, there's top line versus bottom line. I think in HR, the complexities are there. Reduce costs but keep people motivated and engaged. Retain talent, but make structures flatter. So we're facing a number of paradoxes. And the reality is a bit like the LSI, where we talk about, you know, be task oriented, but be people oriented.
LSI,
you have to the lifestyles inventory, which is the human synergistics tool. We talk about you have to do task and you have to do people and you have to do both. And I think that's the reality of the businesses that we're in. So it's not good enough to say, hey, everyone's engaged and motivated and we've retained 97% of talent, but our business is going backwards at a rate of knots. Equally, I can't say to people, hey, we've restructured and saved the business X amount on the bottom line, but we've lost all our key people and people are fundamentally disengaged. You have to be able to deliver against the promise of both.
How important is it then to, in terms of how you frame it? So rather than framing it as an or question.
It's an and.
An and,
it's absolutely an and. You know, it's a bit, you know, dated now. Collins, you know, the tyranny of the or and the genius of the and, you know, back when I started work in the like mid-90s. That's the reality of what we have to do. It has to be an and because the or is not acceptable. It's not acceptable to organisations and it's certainly not acceptable to the people that work in them. And so we have to navigate that paradox and we have to deliver against the promise of both sides of the equation because otherwise people are unhappy and then they won't deliver and then the business doesn't perform.
Tell me about rewards philosophy because I know that firms have different ones. What is a rewards philosophy and what's Campbell's?
For us, it's a very broad definition. And again, it came through adversity. A few years ago, the business was struggling from a performance standpoint. We didn't have as many investment levers to pull. And we actually sat back and looked at everything that we offered to the business. And we said, we've actually got a pretty decent menu here, but we don't talk about it like a menu. And we certainly don't think about rewards in the traditional sense where it's just comp. Because for a lot of people, rewards are about the job they do, about the learning and development they get. We have an Arnott's Foundation, which raises money for a number of charities. It's incredible how motivating that foundation is for our employees. And so we started talking to people about a total rewards philosophy and thinking about all the elements that make up what motivates individuals. Mm. And it's been a real unlock for us.
And that Arnott's Foundation, that's an intrinsic reward, isn't
absolutely
it? And that's sort of the grail, isn't it, of finding what motivates people, if you can tap into an intrinsic reward.
Yeah, but for some people it is extrinsic. And I think it's, again, Richard's about the and. You know, I can't say to someone, well, don't be money motivated. They might be. That's fine. But equally for someone else, it's more altruistic and that's their motivation. We have to accept that both exist and we have to be able to deliver against that for everyone.
On RN, the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts, this is Best Practice with me, Richard Ady. Today, we're looking at culture. And with me are Mary Lemonis, you just heard from her. She's Vice President of Human Resources at Campbell's Asia Pacific. Also, Sean McCarthy, Chair and Chief Executive of consulting firm Human Synergistics. And Peter Hartnett, Head of People and Culture at Sanitarium. And Peter, if we look at your firm, it invested in culture at a time when things were going well. How did an early recognition of it make Sanitarium more resilient? Because it's often the case that management only starts to pay attention to culture when things are going badly.
Yeah, it was an interesting one. I'd only just started and we'd actually done a survey and one of the big issues that actually came out of that was leadership in terms of, like, people thought leadership was quite dysfunctional. So that really made us put a focus on a leadership program across the business, starting at the top, to Sean's point around being CEO-driven. So we started there and we filtered it down. And that really gave us a platform on which to everyone, every leader in the business, to actually get on the same page and to go back to fundamentals and ask ourselves, why are we here? You know, really, what's the purpose of the organisation and what do we expect of each other? What are the behaviours that we expect of each other? That triggered the culture journey for us about 7 years ago. Mm. And we're still on it and we've still got a long way to go. But it's, you know, and it's one of those journeys that I just don't think that ever ends, really.
One of the things about Sanitarium is there's about 1,000 of you, very low staff turnover. So yeah. There's some businesses, some sectors where there's a lot of churn, you don't have much at all. And that, I suppose, makes things harder and easier.
Yeah, it's a catch-22 for us in some ways, because what we need to do is be able to generate new ideas, be innovative, and sometimes you need new blood in to actually come up with those ideas. We've got a turnover rate less than half of industry average. Once people join Sanitarium, they love it so much that they stay. And that's to do with our location. It's to do with who we are as a business, because people really identify with the mission and the philosophy and the values of the organisation. And so they feel very comfortable. So we need to, part of our leadership program is to making sure that people are staying at the edge, staying innovative, being creative about what we need to do to keep ahead of the curve. And that is a real tension for us. I mean, that's something we're very proud of, having the low turnover. But it's also, you know, it can work against you in some ways.
Especially if you decide, as you were just explaining, to kind of change things.
Yeah.
Because you've got, I suppose, institutional inertia.
Yeah. I mean, Sanitarium's an organisation that's 120 years old. And so with that, people are very much part of the fabric of the tapestry of the organisation, you know, once you join. And so we need to be able to monitor our culture, monitor where we are, in order to be able to stay ahead of our competitors. You know, measuring our culture and making sure that we're focusing on that enables that to happen, because it's the constructive culture that enables that to happen. Whether people have been there for a long time, a short time, that doesn't really matter, as long as we're pointed in the right direction and we're doing things new, we're trying things and we're taking risks and we're prepared to fail, that's what matters.
Without giving me anything commercial in confidence, can you give me an example of how you've been able to kind of build and direct culture?
Sure. There's a couple of examples. We took a big leap of faith a couple of years ago to produce a gluten-free Weet-Bix, which is a bit, you know, trying to get your head around that. We're the masters of wheat. And that was a program that would ordinarily have taken probably 2 to 3 years for us to deliver. Okay, because of the time that it takes to understand, you know, how we make it, how we process it, how we, you know, the recipe, everything that fits into that process takes a long time. We were able to truncate that process to 6 months, and that was purely because our people didn't work in silos; they worked collaboratively together, and they solved problems together. And to Mary's point earlier, you know, when things went wrong, no one threw their toys out of the cot. It was like, how are we going to fix this? How are we going to deal with this? How do we break through this? And so we're able to produce a gluten-free Weet-Bix from go to woe within 6 months, which was just a phenomenal effort.
I'm wondering whether you sometimes have to ask questions that you know you're not going to like the answers to.
Absolutely. It's an occupational hazard.
How do you do it in a way that's going to make it worthwhile? Because there's going to be, I mean, there's a cost, isn't there, to do that?
Absolutely. And I think what's interesting, you know, and Peter used the reference point of the different diagnostic tools that we have, whether it be the organisational culture inventory or the lifestyles inventory at an individual level. I think the reality is you then have to have conversations about that data. I heard recently someone use the quote that stories are data with soul. And I think you have to have conversations about the data, because if you don't, it's just the data. And so in doing so, you then have to be prepared to ask questions that you might not want the answers to. You know, so when you ask people for feedback, whether it be at an organisational level or an individual level, you have to be prepared to do something with that. Otherwise, it was a total waste of time, and the credibility the next time you ask the questions just isn't there. And I think it's about how do you deal with it transparently. So if I give a business example, you may be familiar with our Shapes brand.
I am.
You may be familiar with some work that we did with the Shapes brand as Campbell Arnott's last year.
Good. I've got a few things I wanted to say about that.
I'm sure you do. And I'm really pleased to say that a year on, our market share of Shapes is actually higher than it was before we messed with the original Shapes. And what's been fascinating in that I guess, initiative in our business has been how we've actually viewed it, how we, you know, how we knew we were doing something risky. What's been fascinating for me is the reactions that we've had from the business and the people close to the project who've actually said, I really appreciate the fact that the business didn't hang me out to dry when this thing fell over. And in fact, the level of engagement and commitment we've got from a number of those people that were intimately involved with the project is higher than it would have been if they actually hadn't been through that initiative to begin with. And we've learned some lessons and we've been very transparent about them, both internally and externally. And at the end of the day, if you won't innovate unless you're prepared to fail. And for us, it's about saying, you know what, we tried it, it didn't work, we've made some changes and we're in a better place today than we would have been if we hadn't made the change. And so whether it's questions that you want to ask commercially or questions that you want to ask at an individual level when you ask for feedback, you have to be prepared to go there. And I think the purpose of why you're asking the question has to be pure.
I want to come to you, Sean, to wrap this up. When I think of the shapes issue, there are bigger problems than that. I mean, we can point to other much bigger problems, especially in other parts of the world. So VW, huge auto company, very successful at one point, the biggest in the world. They've had some problems. They were caught deceiving people. How do you fix a culture that's led to a problem as big as that?
If the problem is that big, it has to be system-wide. So it's a systemic issue. Again, we come back to the beginning of the discussion. It has to start at the top. There's a belief structure in that sort of organisation that mistakes are not made. And there's sort of a belief structure in the wider world that organisations should do everything absolutely perfectly. Every now and again, you make a mistake. You make the wrong decision. It looked like the right decision at the time. We all do that. And as organisations, we do that. But this was not a wrong decision. This was something within the organisation system that caused it to want to actually cover up and reinvent the truth, quite literally, around emissions and such other issues. And so that's a classic illustration of a systemic culture issue, that organisation-wide there is a belief structure of some sort that has to change. That doesn't happen quickly. It may or may not have an impact on their market presence. They're still one of the biggest auto companies in the world. They've lost a lot of trust in the United States in particular, so their brand recognition or brand appreciation has gone down dramatically in the US, less so here. But hopefully they learn from that. But organisations, I want to pick up a point that Peter used around problem solving. So one of the important things to understand about organisational culture is it's how the organisation goes about solving problems.
Mm.
So is it accepting that we made a mistake, so therefore what do we need to fix it? Or is it not accepting that we've made a mistake and deciding how we go about hiding it? And there are two alternative approaches and absolutely and utterly indicative of the culture. So examples that you have here locally in Australia are indicative of that culture. You've got to be careful that culture can be blamed for everything. Sometimes it's not the cultural issue, but that one that you particularly reference, the VW, quite clearly has been well documented as a cultural issue.
Mm. It also underlines the point we touched on earlier, which is that you can be a successful business, very successful business, seemingly everything's great, and then it turns out that they're not.
Well, the two key words in our industry is success and effectiveness. So success is a short-term measure. Effectiveness is a long-term measure. So Mary used the word sustainability, and that's the key. So I just paint a very quick scenario for you. Most of your listeners will have heard of Enron. And so I was one of two people in our company that were asked to do a culture survey on Enron at the height of their success. And it's one of the few times I've been fired as a consultant in my career. It's not the only time. But here we are, two of us standing up on a stage in front of the so-called brightest guys in the room, talking to them about the issues with their culture, which, to put it in highly technical terms, was the culture from hell. And they said, look, we're so good, people write books about us. Who the hell are you? And they didn't use who the hell. They used a much more expletive word than that to tell us that there's something wrong with our culture. We are successful. And all we could say was, look, we don't know why you're so successful now, but what we do know is you will not be successful for long, because at some stage that culture is going to creep up behind you and bite you in the proverbial. So let's talk again in 3 or 4 years' time and see what's happening. And I think it was about 2.5 years later they went belly up.
That's where we'll leave it. Mary, Peter and Sean, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Sean McCarthy is at Human Synergistics, Mary Lemonis is Vice President of Human Resources for Campbell's Asia Pacific, and Peter Hartnett's Head of People and Culture at Sanitarium. You'll find a link to video of the recent The One Thing About Culture conference on the Best Practice homepage at abc.net.au/rn. And that's the show. Best Practice is produced by Ian Coombe. Our sound engineer is Mark Don. I'm Richard Adie.